From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 8th day of November 2019. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In Chicago today, after this morning's USDA report, December corn gained 2 cents to finish at 377 and a quarter. The March contract there at 386 and a half, up 2 and 3 quarters, and July at 399 and 3 quarters finished 2 cents higher. November soybeans were down 5 and a half cents. The settlement price at 919 and a half. January 931 and a half, down 5 and a half, and July futures at 966, down 4 and 3 quarters. Bean oil up 7 cents. Bean meal down 70 cents. And wheat futures finished the July at 524, 2 and a half higher on the afternoon. Live cattle futures were up 25 cents at 119.25. In the feeders, the November's up 22 and a half cents. They finished at 147. And lean hogs were $64.12, down 17 and a half cents. We're now joined by Mike Zuzalo. Hey, good afternoon.
Happy wild Friday afternoon, Todd. USDA and their reports, they continue to just make the market excited.
Yeah, so today the reason they were excited was because they dropped the soybean. No, they did not drop the soybean. Dang, they dropped the corn yield, didn't they? Down a bushel and 4 tenths. So that was the big number. How'd the market finish up today?
Well, we had the unwinding of the bean corn spread, and that was the once again another big hallmark before a USDA report. We've seen this over and over again when the stock market's rallying, not to mention that it's making fresh all-time highs this week, and you have more of a deflationary mindset. You have a trade that is expecting more of a yield decline in soybeans versus corn, and you have a trade that continues to see really strong bean exports compared to corn exports. Understandably, the bean corn ratio and the NOVDs went up to close to 2.48. That was the highest since at least 2018, maybe 2017, depending upon how you look at the chart. So when you saw the yield in corn go down and the yield in beans stay the same, you could pretty much connect the dots and say, okay, they've overplayed their hands by being long bean, short corn. We got to unwind this spread. And they did indeed unwind that in a big way on Friday. I think there's going to be probably a whole nother week, maybe even another couple weeks of unwinding if the U.S.-China trade phase one deal doesn't get done. I think that's where the beans could unwind quite a bit more of their length, especially the fund length, because I expect Friday's commitment of traders report is going to show that they really added a lot on the managed money side of the equation.
Corn did pretty well today, given what the trade was expecting. Of course, they were thinking that the carryout would be 1.8 million bushels. Only dropped, what, I think 19 million bushels to 1.91. And the reason that happened, I guess, was because they lowered yield 167. That was 118 million bushels they took out of the total stocks, but they took 100 million bushels out of usage as well. That was a big number.
It was, and it was too big of a number if you ask me, especially if you keep going down the report and look at their updates for red meat production versus last month. Net, it's a gain, and I think that number's even going to get bigger because we are gearing up to supply Asia with a lot of pork and a lot of poultry and even a lot of beef. So I think the feed and residual number went down about 25 million bushels. We all know that's kind of a catch-all. It's at the bottom of the bucket. It finishes off the spreadsheet. It's not really the real number. But when you look at the DDGs dropping in terms of consumption because production declines that we've seen recently, I think you've got an issue with the feed and residual number. And saying about ethanol, if we keep up the pace we've seen the last couple, 3 weeks of stronger demand than what I was certainly expecting, given the pullback in production that was announced by the largest the producers, private producers out there, I think even the ethanol number could go back up, and they also cut that. I believe it was 50 million bushels. And so between that and the exports, or excuse me, 25 million and then 50 million on the exports, I think the demand number is much too low at this point. And going back to that yield number, Todd, I think, and I said this on the news wires and to some other media people that it got out there today, that the fact that USDA cut the population on to get the corn yield down to the 167 level says to me, given our cold weather, given our high moisture, and given the slowdown in the harvest pace We'll probably lose more yield in the next couple, 3 months by USDA due to test weights and the girth side of the equation. So pretty surprising to me that they chose the population route to cut the yield.
So you're saying we're going to lose more yield and that we'll be sending more pork overseas. I think, did you see the news story? I don't remember where I picked this up, that Smithfield, one of the Smithfield plants had changed how it's cutting meat for the Chinese market instead of the U.S. market at this point. So lots of things happening. Now, what'd you see in the soybean market for the day?
You know, the soybean market for the day, other than the report, is really trading heavily and even more heavily than the hog market, it seems at this point, because it's put in a lot more premium in the hog market, banking on the U.S.-China trade negotiations. That's understandable because look at what we did on export sales this week. What was it, 1.8 million tons, something like 66.5 million bushels again this week for export sales. So it makes sense why the trade is so giddy about the demand side of the soybean. And we've got Malaysian palm oil hitting a 6-plus week high because of the tightness of stocks. And we, in that Chinese mindset, too, that you just brought up, Todd, we're seeing a lot more substitution where bean oil, palm oil, anything that has protein in it is really being utilized heavily and driving prices higher if it's not pork, because pork can't get a hold of the pork side of the equation. So soybeans have a lot of underlining and underpinning support. Even the planting progress in Brazil that came out from Mercosul on Friday afternoon is continuing to show them very sluggish in the last week and still behind last year's pace. So I think if the corn bean spread kicks into gear, and this is where the wheat is our leader again, corn bean spread kicks into gear and that unwinding takes place. If the wheat's stronger, I think the corn will outpace the beans to the upside, but the beans don't have to lose that much.
Anything from the WASD on the wheat world or domestic that would tell you it should go stronger?
I do think that we are undervalued now in the futures market because of those harvested acres here in the United States being cut. I didn't think WASD cut the Argentine crop and the Australian crop as much as they should have. I'd look for more cuts, but we are getting more and more competitive on the world market, and the world stocks continue to tighten net. So I think the wheat report did not feed the bear, and that's all we need at this point because the prices are so discounted here domestically.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend, sir.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with globalanalytics.biz.
Support for this market report on WILL comes from Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Let's check in now with Eric Snodgrass from Agrible and Nutrient Ag Solutions to see what's been happening with the weather forecast. Hey, good afternoon to you, Eric, and thanks for being with us. What do you see in the weather?
Well, Todd, I'd like to start by discussing what's going on with the pattern we've been in for quite some time now. Things have changed across the North Pacific. We've blocked things up by sending what's called a high over low pattern into the Gulf of Alaska. So the jet stream is trying to come from west to east across the Pacific, but it just splits into a northern branch and into a southern branch. And that is a pattern that's quite dry for the west coast, but it is also a pattern that sets us up for some very cold air that we could possibly get here in the midsection of the United States. Now, over the next couple of days, we are on a bit of a warming trend. So coldest air, last night we got down in some locations in central Illinois down into the middle teens. Well, we're going to be seeing a bit of a moderation in the temperatures throughout the day today on Friday, but then into Saturday and into Sunday. But changes coming after that. And on Veterans Day on Monday, what we're watching is a large area of higher atmospheric pressure sneak down out of the Canadian prairies and really become established in the central United States and in the Midwest. And on the front edge of this high pressure cell, there will be a cold front that will be lifting air, bringing in the chance for precipitation into our area on Monday, Veterans Day. Might start off as a pretty chilly rain and then switch over to snow throughout the day on Monday, so keep a close eye out on that. But it's what's behind this that I really want to talk about. So getting into Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, especially early in the morning, we could see temperatures around here that, when compared to normal, might be 20 to 30 plus degrees colder than average in this area. So we could be seeing morning low temperatures middle of next week that are more normal for being colder than average in February. So this is a very, very highly amplified pattern allowing these troughs to dig through. Now, as the trough is established over the eastern half of the United States, and we are therefore on the back side of it, that's normally a drier time period. So we're talking about cold temperatures with drier weather, which may actually help out with the harvest effort here as we try to get things really finished up in the midsection of the country. So overall, though, I want to see how long this pattern is going to stick around, because it certainly is advertised to be here not only through next week, but maybe even the week following that, with some cooler than average weather still hanging around, while the western United States, which is blocked up in the flow of the jet stream, will likely stay warmer than normal. The clues I'm looking for come from Siberia, and they come from the Pacific and Indian Ocean. In Siberia, when you go over to that side of the world, normally this time of year there is this anomalously large region of higher atmospheric pressure. Now, leading up to this point in time, so the last couple of weeks, the pressure there's been much lower than average. It's allowed for a lot of snow cover to spread, and that large, you know, northern hemisphere snow cover extent is interacting with the stratosphere, allowing our polar vortex to become elongated and stretched a bit. And that's what's helping to reinforce some of the colder air that is in place over us right now. But in the forecast, over the next 15 days, we are actually seeing pressures rebound there. So the pressure's building back up, becoming anomalously high for that region. And that's going to change the position and strength of the Pacific jet stream. What else might be influencing it? Well, our Indian Ocean dipole, which has been much above average, has actually started to decline a bit. At the same time that that is going on, we've seen a shift in the wind pattern across the Central Pacific, namely over our El Nino region. If I could distill all of this down for you, what it tells me is that once we get into the third week of November, we may actually see a strong enough push in the Pacific jet stream that we could finally break down that blocking pattern over the western United States. And that would take us much closer to what I would call normal seasonable weather here for the end of November, rather than it feeling more like the middle of February with these temperatures that we're dealing with right now. That will also most certainly be changing our precipitation patterns too as we look out into that time period. And something I want to be keeping an eye on is what that means in terms of the strength and position of our subtropical jet. Because throughout winter, what typically brings us our biggest snows tends to be a very strong subtropical jet stream flow. So I want to keep a very close eye on all of this as we approach the end of November and beginning of December. Now, elsewhere around the world, I want to take you to Australia first, where things have been very, very dry, especially on the eastern side of the continent. Just recently, over the last couple of days, they've actually seen quite a bit of fire activity in that area as well. And again, you can blame that positive Indian Ocean dipole event on the drought that that part of Australia is dealing with. But with the changes happening in the Central Pacific, namely the Mount Julian Oscillation breaking out of null phase and goes sweeping around into phases 5, 6, 7, and 8, we are seeing changes in the precipitation patterns in South America. Now, over the next 15 days, we are noticing that from Mato Grosso through Mato Grosso do Sul, getting down into Parana, Rio Grande do Sul, those regions, above average precipitation is anticipated. While eastern Brazil, so I'm talking about Bahia, Minas Gerais, Tocantins, Goiás, that region is expected to be very hot and dry. But overall, given that the planting progress is about 50% in South America right now, especially Brazil with planting of first crop beans, this rain will be needed. It will be a good thing for the health of their crop. But overall, remember, when it comes to Brazilian agriculture, they have a very long planting window, and what we really like to watch is how things evolve in January and February. That's the critical time period for the first crop soybeans here. So that's the stuff I'm watching globally. Other than that, I think we just need to around here be prepared for some bitterly cold air in the near term, but possibly a bit of a change in the pattern coming out once we get beyond the second full week of the month of November. So keep an eye on it with me here because some very, very cold air is coming in place, and Veterans Day might see a few snowflakes flying around here.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Snodgrass is with Nutrien Ag Solutions and joined us right here on this Friday afternoon edition of the Closing Market Report. Earlier in the week, agricultural economist Scott Irwin dropped down to my office to record an interview with the folks at Market Journal. That's a production of University of Nebraska-Lincoln. We didn't record their end of that conversation, so I've inserted, summarized the questions that they've asked into the interview for you to listen to. The first question was about harvest conditions here in Illinois.
It has really, truly been kind of a biblical year for U.S. Corn Belt farmers, you know, particularly in the Eastern Corn Belt, it started, you know, record wet and record unprecedented late plantings. The summer growing season ended up being reasonably good in many places, and there's still some good yields out there. But the end of the 2019 growing season and the harvest period is just kind of jaw-dropping about the amount of negative weather events that have occurred. You know, we had an October winter blizzard in the upper Dakotas, a couple of hard killing freezes before the normal freeze dates, and we've had an accumulation of snow. It's incredible wetness in much of the Midwest. And now we're going to be faced next week with some of the coldest weather I've ever heard of in November. So it's really a terrible finish in many areas to the 2019 growing season, beyond just the discomfort that it causes farmers and the difficult field conditions. It's certainly not helping our late maturing and crops that are still standing in the field, which there's a lot. About a quarter of the soybeans are still unharvested, and roughly half of the corn right now. So we have a huge amount of our crops still sitting out in the field and under just kind of an assault from the weather conditions.
Are there any market-related items you're watching for the 2020 growing season?
Well, I think there's two things that are going to be foremost in everybody's minds that watches the markets. You know, one, how are we going to finish up this season? Are we going to end up with the backlog of fall tillage that never gets done this year, just like we did last year, which put us behind the eight ball last spring? And it sure looks like we're going to have something like that. I mean, it's going to freeze up hard for a long period of time, starting about Sunday night this week. And that may help, actually, in getting some of that final crop out. But it's really going to present difficulties in getting the fall tillage done after harvest that we would normally want to see. And then, of course, the big thing looking forward is what kind of recovery in terms of corn and soybean planted acreage are we going to see next year, assuming we don't have the same kind of record wet planting conditions that we did this year.
Do you have an assessment of the planting progress taking place in South America?
I would put it as okay. Not great, but not terrible either. They started off exceptionally dry, delayed planting in some areas. Looks like they're beginning to get more rains, getting things started better, but still has a dry bias in large parts of, in particular, the central northern growing regions of Brazil. So it's something I think that we need to watch to see if they end up having adequate rains throughout the rest of the growing season. I think it's something to watch and monitor. I don't think it would cause anybody to lower their production expectations yet out of South America, but I also think that there could be a little over-optimism in some of the official forecasts that we have from the USDA and some of the South American organizations about the yield potential for the South American crops. You know, they haven't had a great start this year. That's what I really want to say.
Let's turn your attention now to ethanol, where the Trump administration's EPA has been granting small refinery exemptions that the industry, corn farmers and ethanol producers, believe has been backing off total usage. Do you have an assessment?
Now, that's obviously a hotly debated topic. My analysis has led me to say that the U.S. domestic use of ethanol has had minimal impact, if any, from the SREs. Basically, U.S. domestic use of ethanol in the form of E10, or 10% ethanol blends, has largely been protected because it's cost competitive on its own. The real debate is about how much lost potential has occurred due to the SREs in the form of higher blends, growth in higher blends like E15 and E85. I think that's kind of ground zero of the debate.
Can you elaborate?
Sure. The key question is, what does the demand for ethanol look like above the E10 blend wall? I tend to be on the pessimistic side of that because of a variety of constraints, legal and infrastructure-wise, that even if we could go back to an environment of higher RIN prices, the tradable credits that are used for compliance in the RFS, that would certainly have an incentive effect for E15, but my analysis is that it's very small. The ethanol industry and others in ag believe that that growth potential is much larger sooner than I see it. And therefore, they would come up with larger damage estimates from SREs than I do because they have a more optimistic view of what the demand curve for ethanol in total looks like above the E10 blend wall.
What's the future of ethanol look like then?
Well, I think to keep some perspective that while some growth has definitely been sacrificed to the SREs, particularly on the biodiesel and soybean oil side, corn ethanol is at least holding its own. Domestic use of corn ethanol is at least flat. It may not be growing much. It's actually growing a little bit as E10 increases. So that's the good news, is at least the bottom is not falling out, which some of the heated political rhetoric could lead you to maybe believe. But that's not true. It's just we're arguing about growth.
Finally, what's your stance on the grain markets today?
Well, I maintain a moderately bullish bias in my own views, which would lean towards not being too aggressive at selling out of the field. And I think that's probably the way many farmers are behaving anyway. I'm particularly concerned about the effect of the fall weather on harvested acreage and yield for soybeans. The quarter of the soybeans that are sitting out there in a most of them in North Dakota that are unharvested, huge millions of acres of unharvested soybeans out there are going to take anywhere from 0 to 5 degree lows for 3 or 4 days next week. And what I remember is when you go back and harvest those beans, that's not good for harvest loss. So I maintain, I'm most concerned about production declines in soybeans compared to corn, but this probably isn't even good for corn as well. So that gives you a little bit of a slight bias tilt. It's slight because the demand news, particularly for corn, is not very good right now.
That was Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, recorded earlier in the week during a television interview with the folks at Market Journal because they were off mic with their questions. I replaced them with my own voice.